The Weekly Connect on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to The Weekly Connect, the place where we as blind and partially sighted people come together to share our views on the big stories and the big issues that affect us wherever we are. Hello, I'm Stephen Scott, and this week around our table we'll be talking about Guide Dogs UK and the experiences some of our listeners have had with waiting times for a new or replacement dog. We are joined by Diane and Ben, and that discussion is coming up. Also in today's programme, World Connect, hears from Kenyan visually impaired activist and musician Paul Mugambi, also known as That First Blind Person. He'll explain how he came by that name later.
We have not yet achieved equality in terms of persons' abilities, rights, or even in terms of accessing the services.
Later on, RNIB Connect Radio's own Roger Cole is on the other side of the microphone for a change. Laura Kirker chats to him about what he does in his days off. I'll give you a clue. It involves fried eggs, chicken runs, and Bo Derek.
You know, you're jumping around for hours. It's madness.
And Society of the Week this week comes to us from the Royal County of Berkshire, no less, home of Reading FC and, of course, Ascot Racecourse. Berkshire Vision have their own sporting credentials, though, and Stuart is making the most of what they have on offer.
You don't have to be great, and the team spirit is absolutely amazing.
That's all coming up on The Weekly Connect.
The Weekly Connect.
The Weekly Connect.
On RNIB Connect Radio.
So thanks to everyone who's been in touch with us over the last week. It's always great to hear from you, and we always welcome your thoughts about the big issues that we cover and what you want to talk about on the show. This is your programme. If you don't tell us about it, we can't talk about it. It's as simple as that. So get in touch. Now, on that, there's been a lot of discussion in the visually impaired community about waiting times for a new guide dog. Now, you've told us that this was an issue that affected you, so we wanted to make it our top story this week. We reached out to some guide dog owners, and what really struck us was the disparity of waiting times. Someone who responded had been on the list for 4 years, whereas the quickest was 24 hours. Now, we all know it's a complex process of matching and training a guide dog, but how does this affect us as users? Well, guide dog owners Ben Rendell and Diane Woodford join me now to discuss this more. Hi, guys.
Hi.
So we're talking about guide dogs, and it's fair to say a lot of blind and partially sighted people out there are talking about the waiting times to get a new guide dog, and that's why we're having this discussion today. Ben, you are a young guy. There's nothing against that. not to sound jealous, but yeah, you're a young guy, and you have had a dog, what, for about 5 years?
5 years, yep.
Wow, okay. Why did you get a guide dog, first of all?
I lost my sight like when I was around 12, so that's probably about 10 years ago. And I've always been around dogs, really, so it kind of seemed like a natural progression. It was suggested to me. I absolutely hated using a white cane, and I love dogs, so it just seemed like the obvious choice, and it's worked out for me ever since, so...
And when you decided to go down the route of getting a guide dog, how simple was the process for you?
It was quite simple. I had, you know, obviously discussions about how young I was, because bearing in mind I was about 15 at the time. Mm. So it was kind of, you know, will you build handle a dog? So they kind of did all the normal assessments like mobility and you know, obviously all the other stuff about height and walking speed and all that sort of stuff. And then they gave me a dog for like a few days at the hotel, not a dog I was going to get, but just a dog that they had, just to see how I would cope. And then after that, I was put on the waiting list and then got my dog that I have at the moment.
So in terms of the process and the time it took, did you think it was fair? Did you think it was a reasonable amount of time?
It was for me, yeah. It's you know, in all, it probably took about a year. So it wasn't, you know, I thought that was fair enough. You know, because at the end of the day, I wanted the dog that was right for me. Mm. So I was prepared to wait, you know, a bit of time just to make sure I got the dog that would work out in the end.
Okay, Diane Woodford, you're also a guide dog owner.
I am, yes.
And how many guide dogs have you had?
My
you and your
second
first
guide dog.
Okay. And what about the experience for you? How was it? I mean, from day one, so the day you decided to go down the route of getting a guide dog, you know, what was the process like for you?
My first guide dog, I mean, I lost my sight at 38, and I really, you know, one of the first things I wanted was a guide dog. Spoke to other blind people and asked, you know, people questions about what the best route would be, guide dog, cane, etc. I decided I wanted a guide dog. Very naively, I thought you just rang up and chose a cute dog and it took you out and looked after you. You're a bit like going to RSPCA. So I was very naive about the whole process. My first guide dog, actually, I thought was quite quick because they said, you know, it could be up to 2 years for your first dog waiting. So I actually got my first dog within the year, which, you know, was amazing for me. My second dog was my Hydus. My dog retired very suddenly at the age of 8 in the June. I was promised that I would have a dog by the time the clocks changed in the October because I have no night vision whatsoever and was really, really struggling. That didn't happen. And it eventually this really sort of impacted my family. My little boy was at school crying because he didn't want mum not to be safe without a dog. He's only ever known me with a dog. So he was at primary school very scared that mum didn't have a dog anymore and didn't like, particularly felt quite, I don't know, he was a bit unsure about being out and about with me without the dog. So the wait was quite long. But when I sort of investigated it, we had like one of the longest waiting lists, and in fact they were about to shut the waiting list for our area at the time I was waiting for my second dog. But we have very, very little rehab in this area, and the council are quite happily telling people, go to guide dogs, they'll do your rehab. And a lot of people on the list were coming because it was the only way they could get rehab. So there's quite a political background to it, I think.
Okay, so you waited, what, 9 months for your new dog?
I waited just over 9 months for my new dog.
And what's it like? What is that experience like for you going back to, I guess, using a white cane or relying on other people?
It really sort of impacted my social life. It impacted my family. Obviously, you know, the effect it had on my little boy. But my two older children were quite concerned. One was at university and, you know, was quite, you know, concerned that mum didn't have a dog. And I had a special needs child. So it was like, you know, is she going to be safe? And I think
the kids worry.
Was a big thing with me was that I really relied on my dog for safety. Mm. I mean, I'm good at using a white cane, but because I actually tend to move around quite fast as well, I used to find the white canes really difficult. I'd end up getting it tripped in between my legs and tripping over it and things. Not having a dog sort of affected my confidence.
Yeah, I mean, Ben, you mentioned that you don't really like using a white cane, and I think it's one of those interesting discussions, isn't it? You know, it's like white cane or guide dog.
Exactly. I mean, you know, for me, it was just, it just wasn't natural. I mean, I was used to walking around without, you know, walking around unaided, so to then rely on this kind of piece of plastic and metal or whatever was a bit, it's really scary. So I guess a bit of you know, at least the dog's, you know, alive and, you know, it's got eyes and that sort of thing. It probably sounds a bit silly, but it's easy to put, well, it was easy for me anyway, to put trust into a dog. And like, even now when I don't have him, you know, when he's been, you know, away for a few days or whatever, I just don't go out because I find it really difficult to use a cane.
I mean, it's interesting, you know, we're hearing across the country there are varying levels of waiting times for guide dogs. It can be for new people who want to, you know, have a guide dog, you could be up to 2 years. I mean, I've had that myself. I'm applying for a guide dog myself, and you know, I've been told that. And you know, I think when you're told that at the outset, that's probably quite fair, because you're then aware of the expectation. What a lot of people seem to be grappling with and having difficulty with, Diane, is is the waiting times between having a guide dog. So if you've already got a guide dog and you're transitioning.
Quite clearly once, that, you know, they retired my dog quite suddenly and I was told that I was basically high priority. I was top of the list. So I think in my mind that was, it's not going to be long. I do know somebody else who was on the list at the same time as me, and she's only just got her dog, and she's been on the list well over 2 years because it was her first dog. And I felt a bit guilty actually getting my dog because I'd only waited 9 months. But it was 9 months of, you know, it, I think the thing is, it doesn't just affect the guide dog owner, it affects the whole family.
Yeah, I mean, you know, my mum also uses a guide dog, and I mean, she, you know, she hasn't had one for years. She applied for one, and she got one quite quickly a few years ago. But unfortunately, the dog didn't work out because it had medical problems, and they had to retire it. And she goes out a lot. She goes out to help my elderly grandmother who can't go out on her own, and obviously, you know, that affects her as well. If she can't get to her, then she doesn't do her shopping or whatever, and in between waiting for a replacement for the one that didn't work out, it was a year, and you know, she's only just got one again.
I mean, what do you think is driving this? I mean, is it that we are maybe just a bit too hopeful that we can get a guide dog quickly? And actually, the reality is, you know, there's a practical side of this. The dog has to be born and trained. You know, are we maybe asking too much of guide dogs to make it a speedy turnaround? Do we want the organisation to go down that route of, you know, turnaround of guide dogs?
I think my local guide dogs are under an awful lot of stress to keep up with the demand, and they can only work with so many blind people at the same time. And but then guide dogs are doing more and more things other than just guide dogs, and have they taken on too much?
Yeah, and there's that question as well, and you know, they are doing, and there's a lot of targets, and you know, a lot of things seem to be target driven. Anything that's causing an issue as well, because you know, at the end of the day, you know, they have got to be trained, and you want all the time and attention to go into the dog to get the best result possible. So there can only be, you know, a reasonable amount of dogs that can come out of that, unless you start employing, you know, loads and loads of guide dog trainers. And but at the end of the day, guide dogs is a charity, so that's not really, you know, it's not really possible. So I think there's got to be a reasonable amount of you know, expectation when we're thinking about waiting lists and stuff like that. I don't think you can't just expect to have a dog, you know, next week or whatever, unless we can somehow get the resources there to do that.
Diane, to your point, you were mentioning about guide dogs doing too much. What do you mean by that? Well, are they focusing on too much in your mind?
Over the last few years, they've taken on more things like My Guide, and different types of services for blind and visually impaired people. I just, you know, I generally feel that the staff work exceptionally hard, but they can't keep up with the demand of things what needs to be done.
Yeah, I mean, one person can only do so much, can't they? So.
Yeah.
But it is important, I guess, for charities to develop, and obviously, you know, it is a charity and it has to make money, and it has to, you know, in order for it to survive. And also, I guess, you know, and we know, because we've talked about it on RNIB Connect Radio for so long, about the various amounts of work that guide dogs do to, you know, work with new technology companies to develop technology that can assist, not replace a guide dog, but actually work with and assist. So, you know, all that work is valuable, I guess.
I agree.
But are you suggesting that, Diane, that it's perhaps at the cost of the service that people expect from guide dogs?
It's become a very, very big charity, and as is doing loads more to help loads more blind and partially sighted people, which is a good thing. Nobody can argue that they are doing good things, but are they doing too much? I don't know. I think maybe that there's quite a lot of branches off guide dogs, you know, doing lots of other things as well.
Okay. Ben, you know, you're at the point where, you know, kind of midway, I guess, through your dog, and, you know, when it comes time, which will be a few years, let's hope, from now, that before you have to think about retraining, do these stories that we're hearing from people around the country give you any cause for concern about the future with guide dogs and you having a guide dog?
They do, because, you know, I work you know, most days, and I've got to have a reliable way of getting around, and I can't just be sat, you know, kind of waiting for a guide dog or whatever it might be. So yeah, I don't want to be stuck in a limbo sort of situation. So it does sort of concern me. It does sort of make me think that in a few years, is this problem going to get worse? Is it then going to affect me? What am I going to do? How long am I going to be without a dog? And it does really worry me.
Overall, though, are you both supportive of guide dogs as a charity?
I'm amazed with guide dogs as a charity. They have supported me really, really well. Yes, I did have a long way, and yes, it was really, really difficult. But I do understand that, you know, if a dog's not there, it's not there. But it does stop you doing things what you want to do while you're in that period of time. You know, I go up from Yorkshire to London to RNIB to help out at the offices there. But without a dog, I can't do that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I've moved a lot over the last few years and started, you know, different things, and guide dogs have always been there to support me. They've never turned around and said no. So I think the support is there, and the staff and everybody, they work extremely hard to do what they can do for you.
I think my local team works so hard. I think they're under so much pressure that I think it must be so difficult for them. And, you know, it's hard, isn't it? How many more, you know, if you had more trainers, would you be able to keep the list at a reasonable level? But I do, again, with mine, is people are asking guide dogs for rehab training on the grounds they can't get it locally any other way.
Well, that brings up another issue, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You know, which is a totally different issue, actually, but it does bring up the question mark of, because of the amount of cuts to local services, especially social work services and rehabilitation services, and we've seen this across the board, across the country, that these services are now expected to be picked up by charities like RNIB and Guide Dogs.
Yeah.
And that, in some respects, I guess, you know, it is putting a lot of pressure on these charities.
And they're not getting, you know, any kind of support to do any of this extra work. You know, I mean, I asked my local authority for some white cane training around the local area, just so I had a backup, but I was told that I had to go to guide dogs, and they wouldn't do it. So,
Well, I appreciate both of you coming on and being so honest about your thoughts on it, and we appreciate your time, Diane Woodford and Ben Rendell.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, what do you think? Do you agree with what's been said? Do you think that guide dogs are a good charity and they're just under a lot of pressure? Well, what do you think? Do get in touch. And of course, we should say that we've, of course, been in touch with guide dogs about this, and we are hoping that we'll have guide dogs, a representative from the charity, on next week's The Weekly Connect to answer the very points that you're putting out there. Yeah, it really does make a difference to get in touch with this programme, because we can put the questions directly to the people that you may have concerns about or comments about. So do get in touch. The Weekly Connect at rnib.org.uk. And it's an issue we'll be coming back to later in the programme. For now, though, we're off to Kenya to hear about the resources available there. Our World Connect contributor is Paul Mugambi, an award-winning visually impaired activist. Now, he's advocated for the rights of visually impaired and disabled people in his home country since he lost his sight at the age of 15. He's worked with the Kenyan government on policy and with international agencies and refugee camps. But that's not the only feather to his cap. As a musician, he took a name that challenged the Swahili language and changed it for good. Let's meet Kenya's Mpofu number one, the first blind person.
My name is Mugambi Paul. I call myself Mpofu number one. Mpofu number one means first blind person. In Kiswahili, we have the derogatory terms whereby the prefix starts with K-I. Like, for example, kiatu, that's a shoe in Kiswahili. Kiti, that's a chair. These are non-living things. The Swahili people put also the blind among these by saying kipofu. I decided to change that one to give a life in terms of putting now the mwa. For example, mtu, that's a person. So I decided to say, instead of kipofu, I said mpofu. Instead of that derogatory term, kipofu, now it's mpofu. When I started, people started knowing me as Mpofu number one, the musician. The Swahili language speakers or the writers of Swahili have also accepted to change the terminology. They're working out on new books which will be coming up. They won't have the KV prefix. Now it will be M because it is giving life to people. I lost my eyesight in 1997. I was just passing by, and then I was caught up by people who were fighting. I saw all the colors in the world, pink, red, blue. Then I was taken to a hospital. The doctors declared that my power has gone off. From that day, I became blind. It was a difficult moment, but through God's grace, I had to really persevere, forgive those who are fighting, so that I could accept and move on. In dry areas, people face a lot of eye problems or eye diseases because of the lack of water and proper sanitation. So you find that many people become blind, and some of them are also old. They get blindness. In our Kenyan context, we have not yet achieved equality in terms of persons' abilities, rights, or even in terms of accessing the services. So it's still a push and pull situation whereby we have the good policies, but still implementation is very low or inadequate. In Kenya, life as a blind person is a challenging one. Within Kenya, we don't have guide dogs. In terms of braille facilities, although it is available in towns, specifically larger towns, in the villages it's not accessible. Not so many are empowered in terms of access to computers, access to latest phone technology. So for it's still a challenge for us over there. Lack of accessible roads is still a big issue in terms of lack of traffic lights, which are accessible to us. In Britain, they are talking of shared space, which is an issue. But us there, we are talking of potholes being there, trenches, sewage lines being on the roads. I want to inspire you before I expire. I want fire. We still have special schools in Kenya. Even if they are lowly resourced, inclusive education is possible if resources are available. But if they are not, then it's like we are throwing people to the pit. So at the end of the day, many blind persons have undergone through special education schools, because most blind people are trained as teachers. Now things are changing. People are trying to diversify to other professions. My people need employment. You have to give us an opportunity in life. My vision or my prayer is that a day will come when the blind and the visually impaired person will be independent, being able to access services closer to him. I'm hoping in future to start a disability center of excellence whereby I can train people on issues of accessibility. I can empower people to understand their rights, being able to share knowledge and skills to different persons so that they can respect and help the fellow persons who are blind, visually impaired person to access the services readily available within the community where they come from. I see myself in future being the advisor to the UN body in terms of disability affairs and raising the voice of persons' disabilities. I'm proud to be blind. It's an opportunity also to show people or the world that being blind is not a curse moment or it's not a horrifying moment. You can do just like any other person in terms of life. Although I know that being blind, you must work hard or triple hard just like any other person. We can do it. Even better.
Interesting story there of Paul Mugambi and why he has now been called the first blind person. That is World Connect. This is the Weekly Connect.
RNIB wish to say a warm thank you to Waitrose, as this Christmas, RNIB will be one of four charities who benefit from a 10% share of the sale price of Waitrose Charity Christmas Cards. Waitrose Charity Christmas Cards come in a range of designs and packs, and they are on sale now from Waitrose stores and the Waitrose online Christmas shop. RNIB is really grateful to Waitrose for helping us to raise funds and make every day better for those living with sight loss around the UK.
The Weekly Connect.
The Weekly Connect.
On RNIB Connect Radio.
This is the Weekly Connect, the show where blind and partially sighted people like you and I share our views on the world around us. And we hope you enjoyed our Kenyan excursion just before the break there. More World Connect on next week's programme. Now back to our top story of waiting times for guide dogs from Guide Dogs UK. Joining me now is Jane Manley, who is sharing her thoughts and experiences on waiting times for guide dogs. Jane, thank you for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for giving me an opportunity.
Your experience of having a guide dog then, can I ask first of all, what sort of drove you, what pushed you to getting a guide dog?
I'd been a long cane user for about 5 or 6 years and had become very independent and I felt socially able, but I began to realise that my ability was really based on everybody else pitching in and making sure I was standing in the right place, walking in the right area, that I was safe to go up and down curbs, travelling around on public transport, etc. And a guide dog I had thought would give me greater independence, but on the other hand, was nervous about the responsibility of actually having one, having to look after it, wondering what I would need to do, being slightly fearful of taking tests and exams, all the sort of things you think are going to be involved in having such a responsibility when you're given a guide dog. So I applied anyway, and my fears were soon put at rest by the Reading Mobility team, who were able to sort of talk me through, give me an idea of what it felt like to hold the dog when you're walking and so forth, and give me the confidence that it was something I could do, to hand over my trust to an animal rather than my own ability with a cane. So that, you know, that was basically the hurdle I had to cross, and then just it was just the wait for a dog.
And how long in the end did you wait?
I waited almost sort of 2.5-3 years, but part of that was because I'd expressed a preference for a particular breed, and so it wasn't entirely due to the lack of dogs in my area, although in Surrey there is quite a waiting list. It was primarily because I'd hoped for a German Shepherd, but I'm now paired with a Retriever Labrador mix.
What in your mind is a reasonable wait then for a guide dog? I mean, we have to, I guess, accept that there is a huge amount of work that needs to be done. The dog has to be born. That's the
Absolutely.
First thing. And, you know, then the training has to take place, and there's a period of time with all of that. And, you know, then there are people who get guide dogs who, and, you know, it just doesn't work for them. So that then creates another lag on the system, if you like. I guess there must be quite a lot of that. I wonder what is acceptable in that case.
It's also, I think, just to add to the points you've made, it's the fact that some dogs don't make it. So they breed thinking they have 6 to home and they only end up being able to home 4. Mm. So again, that adds to the weight. I think it's so individual in terms of the weight. For me, I would say I felt that I waited longer. You know, I'd have been happy with sort of 18 months to 2 years, purely because I did have the benefit of a sighted partner and an ability to organise my life to make people help me get to where I needed to be. But there are lots of people that are literally be housebound and socially isolated without dogs, either because they've had to give up a dog midway through because the dog can't work or the dog becomes ill or something in their circumstances has changed, which means the dog has to be taken away from them, their original dog. And for those people, getting a replacement dog should be, as it is, the priority. But even so, I'm aware of some people waiting sort of 6-7 months or longer for a replacement. And that to me seems unreasonable. But it is back to all of the issues. There are more demands being made of guide dogs to provide animals. There are more failures within the breeding system, I think, these days. There seem to be more dogs that don't quite make the grade.
We had a comment earlier on the programme suggesting that guide dogs are doing too much these days. They're involved in other aspects of life. You know, for example, they do a lot of work with technology companies now to try and create new alternative ways to get around, or indeed additional ways to get around using a guide dog. They also do a lot of work now with children, Blind Children UK, of course, the charity, which is part of Guide Dogs. A huge amount of work that's going on. Do you think guide dogs are doing too much?
In terms of their relationship with people like Microsoft to build technology and apps and, you know, the additional features, that is important because the new wave of blind youngsters are coming up in that environment. So it's important that guide dogs recognize that as an alternative to a dog. The difficulty becomes when you're saying, well, you know, where is the expenditure going? What are we focusing on? Where is the training? And whether those things are detracting from the budget that we have to spend. I confess I don't know the answer to that. If you look at the accounts, the last published accounts were sort of 2014-15, there was a large amount of money that went to that, but not a disproportionate amount. It seemed reasonable for what they were trying to achieve. The buddy dog system that you mentioned, that's an excellent way of using dogs that aren't quite going to make the grade as guide dogs to actually work with young people and give them the confidence so that as they become older and more able to manage a dog for themselves, they are ready for the commitment and responsibility. So there's a positive because they don't fall out of the system and the dogs that they get are used effectively and properly first time round. So I think it's a difficult question. We are changing as a society, and what we need isn't necessarily for everybody a dog. My guide, for example, the huge volunteer hours that go into that, those are essential for people who still want mobility and social access, but just can't, for whatever reason, have a dog.
We've had a lot of Facebook comments on this, as you can probably imagine. Lots of people have a wide range of views on this. Some saying, you know, the organisation are doing too much. They need to be focused more on guide dogs and training guide dogs because that is what they are. That's what's in their name. There are others, and I quote one who says, I hope this conversation and any conversation we've had already on the Weekly Connect doesn't turn into I hate guide dogs. Interesting mix of comment, of course. And I think, you know, where are you in amongst all of that? I mean, you don't sound to me like the person who's suggesting you hate guide dogs.
No,
in fact, you almost sound the opposite, I guess.
I think where I stand is that I'm looking at them as a solution to a lot of issues. The base that we have of people who are coming through with different types of sight loss need a different sort of response to the standard that we may have begun to appreciate in the old days. And I do accept that a lot of the advertising is centered on fluffy puppies that look cute and can, you know, just get people to extract coins from their pockets.
Yeah.
But
which needs to be done. We accept that that has to be done.
Absolutely. But where I think guide dogs fail is both to the wider community and to their members and users, is that they don't really have an open discussion about what's going on with the other things that they do provide. They're kind of the author of their own misfortune because there isn't a huge amount of interaction, I feel, as a service user, between my views and expectations and understanding and what's actually happening within the organisation. I suppose I stand very squarely in the middle. I feel that there are points that I wish guide dogs would change, and I'm hoping that the change of CEO will breed a new transparency and a new engagement, but that will enable me to understand the broader reach of guide dogs so that I know that what I get from them is just a small part of what they are becoming for the future.
Jean Manley, thank you for your points of view.
Thank you.
Great to hear Jane's point of view there. Thank you for sharing with us. That is what we're here for. We're your space to raise the issues that affect you. And when we hear from you, we know we're doing it right and we're doing a good job. So do get in touch with us with any comments. Your thoughts about this issue or any other topic you want to raise are essential to us doing you proud. You can email us at theweeklyconnect@rnib.org.uk or tweet us at RNIB Radio using the hashtag The Weekly Connect. Staying in the doghouse now, it's not a place I've been for a while, thankfully, but it's time for us to take a pause for thought, if you see what I did there. I know, just can't help myself. Let's meet Jackie and her guide dog, Skye.
I'm Jackie Venus from London, and I have a black Labrador Retriever guide dog called Skye. I've been waiting about a year for a guide dog. I had decided on a guide dog after much pestering by Andrew in the RNIB shop, who insisted that I got guide dog and I ought to get on with it before I lost my sight. So I didn't tell him. I secretly applied for a guide dog and then I waited a year. I was due to have one guide dog in the March. I came home from holiday to see this new wonderful guide dog that I thought was going to be mine because it had the same name as my brother and a nickname of a friend, which is Scooby. And I thought, that's it, it's definitely mine. And then he barked non-stop continuously for 7 days. And I mean, woof, 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 you know, no pause. I mean, how he didn't have laryngitis at the end of the week, I don't know. Being a lawn bowler, it wasn't appropriate that he barked at all, let alone non-stop. And he barked all night. He barked at anybody who walked past the house. And he barked at anybody who came to the door. So as I lived between four schools, you can imagine how much barking he did. And eventually he had to go back to guide dogs. And then about 4 months later, they rang me up and said, we think we've got another dog for you. And we had our first trial walk in a thunder and lightning storm. And even when the lightning hit the scaffolding that was next to us, she didn't bat an eyelid. She just carried on walking and she was soaked to the skin, didn't care. And that's very much been her ever since I've had her, very laid back and very easygoing. She's not bothered by anything really. And she's got a very what if attitude, you know, oh yeah, whatever. We'll do it at my speed when I want to. And she can either go at 0 miles an hour or at 100 miles an hour. And there's no idea about when it's going to happen. She'll just suddenly accelerate and off we go. We had a lovely moment in the local Tesco's. We've been going there a few times and we wandered around the shop and eventually some gentleman in a suit tapped me on the shoulder and he said, excuse me, madam. He said, I'm the Tesco store manager. He said, could I have a word with you? And I'm thinking, oh, no, she's stolen something. You know, she's eaten something off the shelf or, you know, or she's messed on the floor and I haven't realised. And he said, I've been watching you go round with your dog. He said, and every time you've decided on something, you've had a tug of war. You've said it's over here and your dog said it's over there. And he said, I have to say, every time your dog was right and you were wrong. He said, she knew where the mangoes were. She knew where the milk was. She knew where the Coca-Cola was. And he was just fascinated that she knew where everything was. And I was, because I thought, well, how does she know I was actually looking for, you know, stir-fry vegetables and not lettuce, which is what I was looking at. And she's like, no, it's over here. Come on, stupid, over here. She's very much like that. She's very set in her mind what she wants, you know, so if I take her out for a walk and go past the garden centre, we don't pass the garden centre. We go into the garden centre for a cup of coffee.
And if I try to go past it, she won't go. She just looks round at me with that kind of look on her face that says, "Oi, stupid, we go in here." And that's just Skye. She just really is quite positive about what she thinks we should be doing. Well, she loves to meet other guide dogs and jump around. But she's very good in restaurants at going under the table and, you know, just laying there. But she is very quick if somebody drops something. You know, she's shot under the table. She's shot across to where that person is. If anything goes on the floor, she's got it before it's hit the floor kind of thing. I do a lot of lawn bowling. And as part of that, you are expected to stay for an afternoon tea after bowling. Skye's very good. She comes with me and she sits down. And she's very well behaved. She sits there through the whole meal going on. She doesn't pull, she doesn't tug, she just lays there. And then as soon as they fold up the tables and put them away, she hoovers the ground in little rectangles. So the same size as the table, she knows, and she hoovers along the edge and hoovers around the corner, so much so that the club captain says, "I never have to sweep up anymore." He says, "Skye's done it."
So is that one of the big joys of having a guide dog then, that they clean up for you? In that case, I want my guide dog now. Fantastic story. Thanks to Jackie for sharing. This is The Weekly Connect. If you want to get involved and get your voice on air, then please do get in touch. And, you know, remember, you can record as well. We've put up a little podcast on the Audio Boom and iTunes page, so do check it out. How to record on your iPhone. We tell you the way to do that if you've got an iPhone. And if you've got a smartphone or an Android or whatever, then you can do it as well through voice recorder apps on that. However you just want to get in touch by email, that is fine. We'd love to hear from you. Share your thoughts and views on what you're hearing on The Weekly Connect.
RNIB Overdrive is a digital library service for blind and partially sighted people with access to the UK's largest collection of talking books. We also have a selection of talking magazines and podcasts, all available to download onto your computer, smartphone or tablet. For more information, visit rnib.org.uk/overdrive or email the team at overdrive@rnib.org.uk.
The Weekly Connect.
The Weekly Connect.
On RNIB Connect Radio.
Now, before we move on, did you guess what it was that Roger Cole spends his time away from here doing when he's not hosting Pure 70s and Pure 80s on RNIB Connect Radio? What is it that Fried Eggs, Chicken Runs and Bo Derek have in common? Well, the answer is golf. That's right, our Roger has a handicap of a totally different variety once he heads out to the links. Yes, let's hear all about it now as he chats to our very own Laura Kirker.
I'm here with Roger Cole, better known as the presenter of Pure 70s and Pure 80s. Hi, Roger.
Hi, Laura. How are you?
I am very well, thank you. We're going to talk about blind golf.
Ah, yes.
Yeah, so you're a blind golfer. How long have you been playing golf for?
I've been playing for about 5 years now and competing for about just over four, I suppose. Yeah.
How did you get into playing blind golf?
Well, I'd never played before. And it's a strange story. My wife was watching a show called Wanted Down Under, and one of the guys on it was one of the members of English Blind Golf, which is now England and Wales Blind Golf. And she was sitting there watching it and thinking, that's something that you could do. And I'm thinking, yeah, I think I could. So I just sort of pursued it from that moment, really.
And then blind golf, one of the first questions I always get asked about blind golf is, do they have a bell in the ball?
No. No, you play with proper clubs, proper balls, on proper courses. And I think the only difference in the rules of golf is we're allowed to ground the club in a hazard like a bunker.
Right.
That's the only difference. We play by all the same rules.
So how do you, as a blind golfer, how do you approach the ball?
Well, I have a guide who lines me up. Obviously, I've had lessons over the years, so I can get my body into the right sort of position. So he would sort of move me towards the ball, make sure my club is behind the ball, and then it's just a matter of muscle memory, really. You don't need to see the ball. It's more of a nice, smooth stroke through the ball. So you're not trying to hit the ball, you're trying to get the ball in the way of the club.
Get the ball.
Sense?
You get the ball in the way of the club.
Yeah.
It does make sense.
It does.
So is it quite a symbiotic relationship between you and your guide?
Oh, definitely. I mean, it's a 50-50. It's definitely a team sport. 50-50, you know, I might be hitting the ball, but the guide has got to get me in the right direction. Distance-wise, I mean, I've got a talking watch, which gives me my distance from the tee to the hole. Mm. And so I know how far I'm hitting the ball, one stroke to the next.
Yeah, and when you're working out your distances, do you pace out your distances and then come back, or just rely on your technology?
Yeah, when it comes to being on the greens, I mean, that is probably the telling point of a relationship between the guide and the player, because I mean, I might be able to putt the ball at a certain sort of distance in my head, but the guide has got to line me up. You know, there's all the undulations of the green and everything and the distance. So I would be pacing myself out to the hole and back again. And in my head, I've got like, call it six paces. So I'd break that down into a type of swing which would hit the ball six paces away. But the guide has still got to get me in line with the flag.
And have you had any challenges since taking up blind golf?
Oh, I mean, the whole thing was a challenge, you know, from just learning to hit the ball. I must have spent a year, you know, just trying to hit the ball regularly, you know, not even in the right direction, but just hitting it. So, it's definitely a challenge, but one that has great rewards, you know. you know, when you play a brilliant shot, you know, you're jumping around for hours. It's madness.
I understand that sometimes, unless you've got like a partner or a husband or a wife, or as a golfer, it's quite difficult to find guides. Is that right?
Yeah, oh, definitely. Yeah, I mean, there's a fair few sort of couples who play the circuit, you know, both on England and Wales blind golf tournaments and the internationals as well. But yes, the finding a guide is really hard at the moment. You know, there's more golfers than there's guides.
Yeah.
So whoever's listening and they want a guide, go for it, because you know, sort of, it's a great team sport.
You've had 5 years of playing.
Yes.
How good are you?
I'm still getting there. It's last year was my first full season playing in every tournament. That is, you know, all the sort of standard order of merit tournaments. And I wasn't bad, but I could have done better. You know, golf's definitely a game what takes no prisoners. You know, if you're not playing well, it shows, and it did show for me last season.
Would you recommend blind golf to anybody?
Yes. Oh, definitely. If there's any blind people listening right now, pick up a club and join, because, you know, it's changed my life. It's before golf, I was losing my sight, and it was having an impact on me. But now I've got this new challenge over the last few years. It's just sort of spurred me forward, really.
So you definitely wouldn't subscribe to the adage that golf is a walk ruined?
No. I mean, that is an actual positive in it, because not only are you hitting a ball, but you're getting to walk a lovely course in the fresh air, you know, usually. I mean, at this time of year, it's getting quite cold and everything's icy, but it's just a lovely day out. It's unbelievable, you know, the feeling you get when you play something well. It's also irritating when you play it badly, but hopefully my bad days are going to be less. My good days are going to be more.
Well, so. I hope so too. Thank you so much for joining me on the Weekly Connect today, Roger. It's been a real pleasure.
Lovely being here, Laura. Thank you.
I love that Mark Twain quote, golf is a good walk spoiled. Is golf your game of choice? How about goal ball or bowls? Like Jackie earlier. Well, someone else who was bowled over. I can't help myself this week, can I? I'm on fire. Yes, someone else who was bowled over by what was on offer at his local society was Stuart. He got in touch and we heard about our society of the week this week, which is Berkshire Vision.
Hello, I'm Anne Andrea Stannard and I'm from Berkshire Vision. We're a charity for visually impaired people in Berkshire. We were established in 1910, and our main aim is to enhance the welfare of visually impaired people by offering social, practical and emotional support.
I'm Stuart Pearce. I was a HDV driver until I started losing my sight. For me, my sight is that all I can see is a lot of grey and very vague shapes. I was introduced to Berkshire Vision by the ECLO at Royal Berks. She basically told them that I was looking to do something to keep me active. The first thing they came up with was swimming, which wasn't really what I wanted, to be honest with you. And then they came back and said, oh, we can do it for £10 for 6 swimming lessons. And I couldn't really avoid it then. And it was really cool. So I've actually learned to swim, actually.
So we do offer a varied sports program, which has started to become a huge success, actually. We have so far undertaken cricket, tennis, athletics, golf, dragon boating, swimming, tandeming. That's not everything, but that's a few of the activities. This has gone down really well with our members, and I think offered an opportunity not just to get fitter and join in with a sport, but also to build confidence and just get people out having a really good time with a team of people, really. So the Berkshire Sharks Dragon Boat Club members, they've been training fortnightly during much of this year. We do compete, and we are unique in being the only visually impaired team that do compete with sighted teams as well. We've actually competed in races in Pangbourne, Reading, Henley, and also did the Hong Kong Festival this year, so they have done really well.
Jeanette at Berkshire Vision said, do you know what, we've got a cricket team, how do you fancy having a go? And I was like, yeah, I'll give it a go. Never played cricket before. Went along to one of their coaching sessions and kind of enjoyed it. And I played my first game a year and a half ago against Help for Heroes. It was awesome. But then after that, my consultant warned me about my retinas and said that I had to stop doing everything to try and protect my retinas a bit. But I missed it so much, you know, and I was like, do you know what, I need to get back to it. And this season, I've played nearly every single game because I can't get enough of it now. It's called the Berkshire Stags. Thankfully, because it's a development league, you don't have to be great. And the team spirit is absolutely amazing. You know, so that's what I love about it.
Virtually all of the services we provide and all the support we give is heavily supported by volunteers. And it's really important to say that there's a lot that we do that we wouldn't be able to do without those volunteers.
Volunteers are amazing. It's very difficult to see how a lot of these places would run without it. Volunteers are so important to everything. You rely on it. You know, and it's the same with all these charities. They're the same. Berkshire Vision is exactly the same. Volunteers help out so much.
Do you have a society that you want to thank? Is there a place that has helped you and you feel it could help others as well? Well, nominate your Society of the Week by dropping us an email to theweeklyconnect@rnib.org.uk or tweet us RNIB Radio using the hashtag TheWeeklyConnect. I cannot say it enough. It is our connections that make us stronger and better and more able to achieve. Let's meet one of our RNIB community connectors now on that very theme. Binny joins me on the line from Montrose. Hi, Binny.
Hello, Steve. Good to hear you.
Listen, lovely to have you on. You are the first RNIB community connector that we are speaking to. It's part of our new series called Meet the Connectors. Got to ask the question, Binny, how did you get into doing this?
Well, it began because I needed a volunteer to help me exercise my guide dog. And there's a group in Angus called Voluntary Action Angus. And they provided me with support for that and also support to get to hospital appointments. And they asked if there was anything I would like to do. And only the week before, I'd received information about RNIB Connect improving services in your area. And I said, yes, I would be most interested in helping, working with RNIB to find out about how we could set up something in Angus or this Montrose, because there are some other groups further away.
So Montrose is, what, just a bit before Aberdeen, is that right?
Yes, it's 40 miles south of Aberdeen, and it lies directly between Aberdeen and Dundee. Equal distances, actually.
Okay.
About 30 to 40 miles to Dundee from here. So we're bang slap in the middle of Angus. Angus consists of a lot of smaller places, Arbroath, Monifieth, Kirriemuir, Forfar, that kind of thing. It doesn't have a lot of... I don't think there's been anything ever for visually impaired people here.
Mm. So what do you hope to achieve as an RNIB community connector?
Well, what I'm wanting to do is work with RNIB to help develop more choices for folk with sight loss. They are enjoying... We have about seven or eight people meeting together every fortnight, and they're beginning to enjoy it, and people are coming back, which I'm so pleased about, because...
So you've already started the process, then? You've got people coming together into one place?
Yes, I began with the help of Voluntary Action Angus and RNIB, because RNIB sent out all the invites. Yes, we began our group on the 22nd of September, and we meet fortnightly at the moment in the Park Hotel, but we may be changing it after New Year to a sheltered housing complex. That's still under discussion. Yes, I wanted to do something for visually impaired people here, and I thought they would enjoy meeting. And it's proved that they have enjoyed it. They do want to do it. I would suggest to anyone, get in touch with your voluntary organisations locally, link them with RNIB, and you'll get a lot more support in getting the service started. We want to include more visually impaired people, and this is why we are looking around for the right venue so that we can get speakers and get other things and maybe get outings organised on. I mean, even things like folk to have a fish and chip night or something, you know, maybe a meal at tea time and a chat. You know, that could be something we do one day.
Well, if there's food involved, sign me up, Benny.
I'll phone you, Steve. I'll let you know. But you've a long way to come.
Worth the journey, though, I'm sure. Benny,
I will be, yeah.
Benny, wonderful to talk to you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for asking me to be interviewed. It's a privilege, Steve. And I'm glad that, and thank you for Connect Radio. It's terrific. Really love it.
Great to hear from you, Benny. Thank you for taking the time to listen and also talk to us. You can continue the conversation by emailing theweeklyconnect@rnib.org.uk. On next week's programme, what do you prefer, mainstream or specialist education? It's a big topic we're getting into on next week's The Weekly Connect. Thanks for listening.